and welcome to episode 2 of series 2 of the Dorset Growth Hub podcast. In this episode, Rich chats to Dr. Chris Chaplio, Associate Professor in Societal Marketing at Bournemouth University. They talk all about branding. Chris talks about what makes a brand successful, personal branding versus corporate branding, how you can measure success, and how brands can continue to reinforce their brand messages. This episode is recorded in partnership with Bournemouth University. They are supporting our Sales and Marketing Month, and we have included some questions from students from the Bournemouth University Business Society at the end of the episode. If you want to expand your knowledge and learn a few new things, there are free online workshops to accompany these podcasts, so visit dorsetgrowthhub.co.uk/podcast to see what's on this month. Now, over to Rich and on with the episode.
Okay, so we are joined today by Dr. Chris Chaplio, who's an associate professor from Bournemouth University, associate professor in marketing. So Chris Chaplio's research interests are in marketing and branding in the nonprofit sector, particularly education. He has published and spoken widely on aspects of higher education branding and is involved in ongoing consultancy projects in the sector. Prior to academia, he held senior marketing roles in the publishing and leisure sectors, as well as higher education. And he's currently working on research into brand orientation in the nonprofit sector. The focus of the discussion today is around branding and falls into our sales and marketing content for the Growth Hub, which is our focus for the month of February. And we've got some brand new podcasts and some online events, which are all aimed at helping SMEs to fight the challenges that we face in these times. We want to explore the diverse world of marketing through different lenses, including academia. So today, Dr. Chris Chaplio is here to do that. And welcome, Dr. Chris. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Nice to see you.
And where are you today, Chris? You're at home? Are you at the university?
No, the university, sadly, is we are all working remotely, other than by exception. So you're speaking to me at home down in kind of just by the sea in Southbourne.
Lovely. Is the sun shining or is it a bit rainy today, isn't it?
The sun is anything but shining, actually. it's very grey and overcast. I think it's what we call bracing.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. Well, welcome, Chris. It's great to have you on board today. And thank you for spending a bit of time to join us on this podcast. I'm very much looking forward to hearing what you've got to say around branding. And just so you know, so I studied marketing, finished in 2005. And do you know what I was trying to do last night, Chris? I was trying to find my dissertation up in the loft, which was all about the power of branding. And wow, it was based around a book that was published regularly back then called Super Brands. And Do you know what, Chris? I couldn't find it. I was going to launch today with reading some extracts from my dissertation that I thought we could kind of talk around, but I could not find it. I'm gutted.
What a shame. Now it would all be online as well, I guess.
Wouldn't it have been really interesting to see what my mind thought back then? And this is before the dawn of social media and all of that sort of stuff. So anyway, but welcome, Chris. It's going to be great to have a little chat to you about sort of focusing around branding. So should we just start this off? Do you want to just tell us, I know I did a bit of a preamble about your sort of role at Bournemouth University, but it'd be good to know a bit more about you as an individual, your research and your teaching.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I like to think, though I've been in academia for sort of since year 2000 or thereabouts. Prior to that, I worked in industry in a number of roles, and I've always tried to maintain one foot in industry. So, whether that's with consultancy or bringing the best of academic knowledge to businesses, so yeah, I'm trying to kind of tread that path. But particularly, I've become very interested over the last few years in marketing doing. Putting it simply, doing good things. I mean, we all know about many of the issues around consumption and overconsumption, and that's traditionally where the marketing model came from, to encourage people to consume and consume more. And yeah, of course, businesses have to succeed. But I've become very aware of where marketing and marketing skills can do positive things for societies, for economies, et cetera, et cetera. And the marketing skill set can be used there. So I'm doing some work at the moment around changing positive behaviours around things like health and using marketing skills in that arena. And hence the work you were talking about with charities as well, and the charity sector and the education sector, where marketing is these days a very important part of their tool set.
So in regards to then branding, okay, so branding is a bit like saying, I mean, I work in and around sort of digital, right? It's a very broad subject, branding, very broad subject. So what? How would you describe what a brand is?
Okay. Well, great question. It's a great opening question. A brand is, I mean, I think one of the best analogies I've heard, and I've used this many times, I only want to explain it simply, because textbooks are littered with very good and sometimes precise academic definitions of what a brand is. I have to say, they don't all quite agree. Every major writer, if we're looking at Kotler or Keller or all of these kind of authorities, all have a slightly different version, but saying a similar thing. However, I think one of the best analogies is it's like an iceberg. So you might see the bit above the water, the little tip of the iceberg, is the logo. And this is a common misconception out there. When people talk about their brand, they'll talk about their logo. So, you know, if you take a brand like Nike or Mercedes or Adidas or any of these guys, so we all know the logos. We can straight away identify those logos and associate them with the company. However, it's the bit below the water, the bit of the iceberg below the water, which is the vast majority, which is the, in many ways, the important bit and where the hard work is done. And that's the values, the images, the associations that are all linked to that visual representation, linked to that logo. And that is so, so important. And arguably, it's where the real value of many companies lie. You know, straight away, when I see one of those logos, I see Mercedes, or I see, I'm giving classic consumer brand examples here because we all know those, or I see the Coca-Cola logo, or the classic one, which every student seems to use in a thesis somewhere or other, is Apple. We see the Apple logo, we all know, and we associate certain values, images, products with it. And that is the essence of a brand, really. It's they're simple in many ways, but they're also psychologically quite complex.
So what makes, I mean, you've cited quite a few examples there then. So for instance, Apple, what does make it successful? What do those elements look like?
Well, that's a great question. And I guess I can't answer it absolutely precisely in a couple of minutes. But the essence is that Apple have carved out a distinctive position for themselves. And many companies, this is what, you know, brands strive to do. We all are in a crowded marketplace, crowded in terms of products, offerings. People can source and buy things globally. And your brand is where real distinction lies. Now, Apple have history, they have heritage, and that's an important building block for a brand. But you don't have to have that. You can be a new brand that comes in and carves out a distinct niche. And if you had 20 or 30 people who are listening to this podcast, or 20 or 30 students at the university, you sat around the room and said, write down four, straight off the top of your head, don't overthink it, write down three or four words you associate with Apple. I would think they would talk about innovative, stylish, well-made, alternative, et cetera, et cetera. And Apple have tried to position themselves over the years around innovative design, functionality, and looking products and different user systems. And, you know, have done that. You know, no company is immune. No company can sit back and think, well, we can rest on our laurels, because as we all know, Apple, whilst they're still a huge brand and one of the biggest brands in the world, I think arguably, depending on how you measure it, the biggest brand, but they're not immune to competition. So it's about how finding out how they continue to maintain that distinctiveness, and not just distinctiveness that people want. It's got to resonate with people. It's got to be, you can be distinct, but if people don't get what you're about and want what you're about, and of course the world is even more complicated now. I know we've got questions around this in the moment, because it used to be that brands could decide upon their imagery, decide upon their associations, and then put in place marketing communications to communicate that. These days, there's a cyclical thing going on where consumers shape your brand. Co-creation, we talk about a lot in marketing theory and when we teach marketing at university, where consumers will take your brand and they will be part of the narrative. So it's no longer you saying, hey guys, this is who we are, this is what we stand for. The very people who use you and who, you know, retweet things about you or these sort of things will shape your brand as well. So as I say, it's psychologically complex. Yeah, and I hope that answers the question about Apple or other successful brands. It's distinctiveness and its appeal and resonating.
So, Chris, you touched on measuring in that last question. So how do you measure a brand? Is it achievable? Can you do it?
Well, it bear in mind that the greatest, you know, I think Interbrand, who are the biggest branding agency in the world, one of the quotes I often use from them is the brand is the most valuable asset any organization has. And there's a huge interest, therefore, and a need to measure and attribute a value to brand equity. And there is many, many companies doing that, and many academics are doing that. There is no one absolute way that I'm aware of. And I have looked into this because I became quite interested in, well, it's one thing for, you know, Nike or one of these guys to measure their brand, but it's difficult for a charity or a university or a school. How do you actually, you spend £100,000 on marketing, how do you attribute, you can have uplifts in sales, but that isn't all just about the brand. How do you measure that increased value in brand? I mean, I would point you towards, without giving a kind of hour and a half lecture on it, there's a guy called Aker, who's one of the key marketing writers who has a brand equity measurement tool. There's Keller, Kevin Lane Keller, an American marketing academic. And then there's agencies, commercial agencies like Mark Plus Insight is one of the ones I'm aware of. So brand equity. And brand equity is an amalgamation of various constructs, things like, you know, the financial value, the distinctiveness, the awareness, etc. Other people, by the way, are measuring particular specific examples of that. So you might measure your brand awareness, the number of people who are aware of a company or an organization before your branding program and afterwards. And you can track that over time. Your distinctiveness, your positioning. But basically, brand equity is the key way. And there is a big financial value attributed to brands, as you know.
Yeah. So it's interesting, branding. So some of the examples we're talking about are sort of big corporate brands. So when we take it to the other end of that spectrum, and in context to Dorset, for instance, so Dorset is pretty much made up of 90% micro entities, okay? So you're five or less employees in an organization, and a lot of startups as well. So why should a startup, for instance, focus on brand when probably sales and growth and, you know, kind of, right, we need to get our product out there and market it. Why should they focus on brand as a startup?
It's a great question because it sounds like a luxury. It sounds like something that big companies should be doing, and it's for them, and it's fine for Coca-Cola to do it. But, you know, if I'm a little startup and I'm just working all the hours there are just to get my company up and going. But it doesn't mean you don't have to have a huge comprehensive branding program and brand analysis in the way that some of those big corporates I've talked about, simply because we all know them, you know. It's about a couple of things, I would say. It's about your long-term strategy, because you might get some sales in the short term, but you also need to build longevity. You need to build your brand equity for the future. And, you know, restaurants and leisure sector for years have talked about goodwill, the value of goodwill. When you sell a restaurant or a cafe or something, you value the goodwill. That effectively is the brand equity. It's the imagery and hopefully the positive imagery and the associations that people have of your company. And that is the value of the brand. So I think if you don't think at all about your brand, you're not thinking about how you're distinct. You're not thinking about your unique selling points or unique selling propositions. And you're not thinking about longevity. So it doesn't mean I fully, you know, if I'm taught, and I have done consultancy for very small businesses who sort of rightly said, we don't, you know, we can't have a formal program like this. We don't have the time, the expertise and the finances. But nevertheless, just thinking about at a very simple level, visual consistency, make sure that everything you do looks the way you want it to look and portrays a consistent visual image. And that filters through to actually the way you say things, the tone of voice, the messages. It's about having a distinct image that you manage and being consistent about that. And that, to me, I think is the value of a brand, whatever size organization, even for an individual. And, you know, let's be honest, individuals are brands. We all talk about celebrities being brands. Many academics in the sector I work in have tried to sort of manage themselves as brands. Because, you know, think of how much information we all have in our heads. Think of that. You know, we cannot sort and sift everything in a rational way. But when we see an image or a face or a person or a name we know, straight away, hopefully positive associations jump into our mind and it makes our purchase decision or a decision to interact easier. And that's what we want. Be you a tiny company or a huge multinational, you want to have part of the work done for you, because straight away when people see your imagery, hear your name, they want to interact with you.
It's an interesting point. And this is something I find really interesting, actually, when working predominantly supporting micros who are looking at their marketing and, you know, and trying to piece it together. You know, they suddenly go, right, I need to give this more attention. I need to focus on branding. I need to focus on digital marketing. So you touched on this kind of personal individuals branding. So personal branding versus corporate branding. There's been a shift, hasn't there, in the past, probably, let's say, 5 years or so with you know, the likes of Instagram, Snapchat, all of those social channels where the individual seems to be at the forefront of stuff, of communications, of the brand. And but there might be a product or service then behind that. So has it changed? And are the brand messages of old, are they fading out? And is it always about the individual, or is it depending on perhaps sectors? Well, what are your thoughts on it?
I think the whilst the platforms and the tools and the way that brands are communicated have changed hugely, because as I say, even 25, 30 years ago, big advertising and marketing agencies, branding agencies, some of whom specialise, will come up with a program. They would use all the media channels and integrated marketing comms program, where they would use TV, broadcast media, et cetera, billboards, and they could portray the image they wanted. It wouldn't always be received in the right way, but they had a high degree of control. As you rightly say, now it's become often about the individual. But I still think the psychology is the same. The way that that's being done has changed, but the psychology is the same. We all take on board information. We assimilate it. We process it. And when we do that cognitively, we do it almost subconsciously. But this is where marketing and psychology meet in branding. Understanding that is so important about how people perceive you, how people understand you. And so I think the role of the individual in that is important. But I would say it has changed hugely in many ways. But don't forget that it is still people making buying or interaction decisions, and people have not changed that much. So yes, it's changed, but not to the extent that everybody thinks at the basic level.
Okay. So we're going to reflect a bit, I guess. Let's look at the year that's, if we want to do that, the year that's just happened. Many things have happened.
Yeah. yes.
But let's break that down into a sector in particular who probably struggled the hardest, I would say. And I think many would agree, many might disagree. But the leisure sector, so it has been hit particularly hard. How do you think branding, for instance, can help that sector?
I think it's still just as important. I'm not going to sit here, and when companies are absolutely strapped for cash, many of them, their survival is in question. So, yeah, you should be spending a huge amount of money on marketing and branding, what they call above-the-line activities. That is, activities which are external, paid-for advertising, etc. However, if you have come out of this with a focus on your brand, you hit the ground running. You know, there is an argument. I remember reading this many, many years ago, that, you know, in a recession, companies should spend as much, if not more, on marketing, because when they lift out of that recession, they will be the ones that see a quicker uplift because people are aware of them. And we are all, you know, this has been a very, very difficult year for everybody in every way. And of course, the leisure sector more than anybody. But when things do get back to normal or some normality and people want to go out and consume, they will migrate straight away to brands that they know and they trust and that they have a relationship with. And that relationship part is really interesting, because there's been a lot of research saying that actually many people in their lives, and interestingly, without in any way wishing to generalize, well, I am doing generalizing a bit, I suppose, but I've seen research that said that women tend to have deeper relationships with brands, slightly less functional than men. Of course, there's exceptions to that. But so they will actually often regard brands as almost friends, the brands that really have a positive influence in their life. And if you are a leisure brand, be it a holiday company, you know, it's interesting. You know, if you look at TUI, the big travel operator now, they're doing a lot of marketing, a lot of advertising, and they're also giving reassurance. Because whilst we've lived through the last 20 years in a time where we can all travel very independently, we buy an EasyJet flight, we buy a Ryanair flight, we book our accommodation, there's been a move now for people to want reassurance. And so TUI, I think as a brand, you know, it's a very good time for them, because they inherently have that reassurance and they're pushing that as part of their unique selling point, I noticed in some advertising today. So it's about hitting the ground running and coming out of it ahead of others, and doing that in cost-effective ways as well. It doesn't have to be spending a load of money that you don't necessarily have. It's about using your social media, your online, your public relations in an effective way and trying to keep that message out there. And a message which is current and fit for purpose for the time we find ourselves in.
Sure. I mean, I remember quite a few months back in the initial first lockdown, I did a little webinar series called Adapting with Digital to just look at what digital was doing and how we could use it in the times that we're in. And we had a guest each week. One of the guests we had was Matt Desmier, who's a local kind of branding and marketing consultant.
I know Matt. Yeah,
has a lot of ties with Bournemouth University of old. So one of the things Matt talked about, and I thought it was a really good concept, was not going dark. Don't go dark as a brand. And kind of correlates to what you're saying about if there's ever a time to focus on marketing and branding, it is now, because so many people felt that, you know, if they couldn't trade, for instance, then hey, well, let's stop talking as well, because we can't do much. But actually, like you said, if they're coming out the other side and they've not been focusing on that, they're a lot further behind at that point. And I think that's true. And I think we saw that.
Yeah. And not going dark is a great way of putting it, actually, as I would expect of Matt. And because you think about it, we all have in our own lives, if you rationalize it, we have particular restaurants, pubs, places we go on holiday that we have a relationship with. It's hard to rationalize that. We just feel a warmth towards them. And you want that to be maintained, even if it's a low level, just keep that conversation going. Not easy, but keep that conversation going. They talk about front of mind awareness, so that you're recalling straight away and you don't slip into, as you were saying, the dark areas.
So just looking at recent times, so going back almost before the past year and the challenges that we had, but branding over the years, so it's shifted, hasn't it, with digital. So the past, say, 10, 15 years, a lot of companies have switched their efforts online and focused branding efforts, marketing efforts online, as most are doing these days. But how has that affected a business and its brand in a positive or negative way?
I think there's no simple answer to that, really. It depends upon how the company has embraced the technology we find ourselves with, and most of them embraced it very well. Digital marketing has opened up a wealth of opportunities, but for companies that haven't moved with that, it's thrown up a wealth of challenges as well. The biggest single thing, I think I touched upon this earlier, is about, well, a few things that are very current in marketing these days: experiences, you know, retail, leisure, etc. It's no longer about just buying a functional transaction, buying a product. It's often about the experience and trying to market the experience. Be that the experience of going to a shop or to a retailer, making it into something like this, because they have to. Retail is another sector, you know, where obviously challenges are magnified times many. And so that's often about offering something different. And the other big thing is co-creation. Co-creation and the fact that you have to work with your stakeholders. And I don't just mean your customers there, I mean your stakeholders, which includes your customers, but also includes your competitors, your suppliers, other, you know, people like yourselves are a stakeholder for many businesses because you have a vested interest in what they do. Work with them to create a story and to maintain your presence. So co-creation is not easy because not everybody will say what you want them to say, but you have to embrace that and live with that and try. And I think these days, consumers, I talk to a lot of obviously very bright younger people at university, and they are very savvy. They are very aware. They will see through a brand that is not genuine, that is not doing what it says it's going to do, very quickly. And of course, social media has made that transparency even greater. So you might get away with it for a while, but you won't get away with it long term. So keep an honest, open conversation, and hopefully, if you're doing the right things, saying the right things, and providing products and experiences that people really want, your consumers will work with you to co-create. And, you know, when I say that, at the simplest level, it means people retweeting or reposting or liking and saying, these guys are great, use them. Because if it's somebody else, independent of you saying it, it has even more resonance and value.
Is there, I mean, this is a concept, I don't know if this is a term or not, but I'm going to say it sounds like it might be a term. Maybe okay. It was in my dissertation all those years ago, and maybe it's just come back to me. Over-branding. Can you know, you touched on earlier about brands being like friends. Are businesses trying too hard at the moment to sort of be in our pockets and be our best friends during these difficult times or not?
I think there's a fine line. I think you're absolutely right. There's a fine line. You know, it seems to me every time I look at any TV advertising, and TV advertising It's still vast, despite we talked about the digital revolution, but TV advertising is still vast and is still, for big mainstream consumer brands, a significant source of brand activity and where they spend a lot of money. But it seems to me a lot of them are sort of trying to be it building societies, holiday operators, financial services companies, all trying to offer reassurance and talk to you in a kind of way like they're your best friend. I think there is a danger that sometimes, because our relationships with certain brands that are different. So I think a lot of financial service providers, for example, a lot of the reason that people stay with them is legacy. You know, it's because inertia. You know, it's difficult and complicated to move your bank, your building society, your mortgage. It may not be as complicated as it used to be, but people still see it as an inconvenience. They may not love the company. They just, it's a transactional relationship. And I think when companies actually assume that to be, or interpret it to be, a closer real relationship and real loyalty, that can be risky. So I think some of those organizations at the moment are overbranding, if you want to call it that. They have to be careful about how far they try to be our close friends. Having said that, there are financial services companies that have carved out some of the online banks, you know, Egg and Starling and people like that have at their time carved out different positions and some distinctiveness that's resonated with their core target group, not with everybody, but with the target audience. And of course, we haven't talked about that. It's about knowing who your audience are and what you want to say to them.
Do you know what? I'm going to tell you something, because one of my pet hates in branding, and it's, well, it's TV advertising, really. And I might misquote here, so apologies if I do, but there, a couple of years ago, maybe up to a year ago, there was, it was Southern Comfort, I think, one of the whiskey makers,
did
an advert, and they had a famous actress, and I think it was Mila Kunis, it might not be, but she was seen in the kind of the cellar where all the oak caskets are, hammering away and working in there and talking in the terms of saying, we at Southern Comfort, let's assume it's Southern Comfort. And to me, it was laughable, because it was making it look like she worked there and she was the voice and was saying we. And that's what that's my pet hate, is when you have a famous person who you know doesn't work in that company talking about them being there. I just, to me, really feel that, I don't know, I just don't get it. To me, it just doesn't add up. And I'm like, well, you don't work there, so why are you pretending that you do? Just a little pet hate, Chris, I thought I'd share with you.
I think that's a classic example of underestimating your audience. But it's part of, I'm aware of the Southern Comfort ads, and Southern Comfort are very much about trying to, another big phenomenon we've seen in branding over the last 10, 15 years. It's not new, but it's sort of, it's on topic as a recognized area of branding, is storytelling. And they're very big on that. It's about telling a story about their heritage. Because let's strip that down to the bare essentials. What are they going to say? It's a strong alcohol, which people like to, you know, drink and party with, etc. But what they've moved away to is the history, the heritage, where they're from, and creating an imagery around that, which many, many companies do and do quite successfully. But I think you have to be careful not to underestimate the intelligence and the savviness of your audience, especially the generations now. You know, you do that at your peril, really. If you look at advertising from, like, quite a long time ago, the early eras of mass advertising, the 1950s and even the 60s, they look astonishingly naive now. They're charming, but they're very naive. You know, it's Guinness is good for you. And, okay, well, that message is quite strong and has resonated. But some of
them hang on, Chris, are you telling me Guinness isn't good for me?
Well, I think
you can't be telling me Guinness isn't good for you.
probably good for you in moderation, I would say. It depends how much. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to watch what I say here, in case, because Guinness have good lawyers, I don't doubt.
Brilliant. Sorry, Chris, I think I interrupted you mid-flow there. But
No, I think I'd reached my conclusion there. You shouldn't insult your audience, and I think to try and be genuine. And we all see ads that we find a little bit twee, a little bit supercilious, and, you know, And the use of celebrity culture, I think, celebrities, we could get into a whole area there about how many celebrities are brands. The classic one, one of the first big brands, is David Beckham, who, you know, is a brand and therefore associates his brand and the Beckhams, both of them, with many other organisations and companies. Do they really use all those, you know, and do they? It's something for us to work out for ourselves, but I think companies sometimes can underestimate. And the ones that have an honest, open conversation do resonate, I think, better.
But then it's also the audience type, isn't it? And who is it aiming at? And perhaps, you know, on a personal level, those that I don't associate with, it's very obvious then perhaps it's not aimed at me and my way of thinking. And, you know, that's a big part of this, isn't it? In the whole branding kind of storytelling, which we've touched on. And in fact, we've got a question around storytelling from the Student Business Society, which we'll come to a bit later, which is the business society that's based at the business school at Bournemouth University. So we've got some students answering some questions, and one of them is around storytelling. But yeah, it's, you know, your audience and aiming it to the right audience in the right way. And you know, there's so much thought that goes into certainly what you see on TV in terms of audience type. So clearly I'm not someone who's going to be drinking Southern Comfort or appeal to that type of storytelling, I guess.
Yeah.
So, Chris, we're going to kind of leap forward now. We've reflected a little bit on the last year and then looked back at the sort of last 10, 15 years and the shift with branding in the digital space. So let's look forward a bit. And in terms of this year or the years ahead, branding, what does that look like? What's going to change or not? What's your thoughts?
Well, I guess I can answer that probably fairly succinctly by referencing some of the things I've said already, really, in that, and of course, nobody really knows, because the one thing we've learned is that the world changes and changes very fast. I still think people will buy from organisations and companies that they trust. And so you can get so wrapped up in the actual technology, the channel of communication, that you forget the basics. It is people interacting and buying from companies that they feel have a relevance to their lives and that they have some trust in. You have to caveat that by saying that consumers are ever more aware and ever more, not everybody, but discerning. There's a whole area of psychology called cognitive dissonance, which marketers use and understand it quite a bit, or good ones should, because that's where we might want to be do the right thing, but sometimes we will mitigate that because we have to make a kind of functional choice. But I think you have to be aware of your consumers, as you touched upon earlier, not insult them, understand who they are. I think we're going to see more and more co-creation. We're going to see, well, people still buy from, as I say, people still work in the same way, that they will be looking for branded experiences. They'll be looking for openness. They'll be looking for companies that have a clear, resonant message that they feel is fit for purpose. And, you know, that's couched in the far bigger global issues we talk about these days. So I think co-creation is going to be a way forward. Experiences. So we're still going to see storytelling, because that cuts through the clutter. It can actually make an emotional, because a lot of a brand is an emotional appeal. It's not just a functional thing. And so that emotion through storytelling will still be there. And there's a lot of talk about a phenomenon called brand love, which is really, I guess it does what it says on the packet. It's about where people really feel a strong affiliation with a brand, because it does help them in their lives in some way. And some brands are better set up to do that than others, really, depending upon the sector they're in and the particular type of product.
And in regards to you, Chris, and your research and teaching at Bournemouth University, what are you going to be focused on this year from research and also in teaching? Anything new coming along?
Well, teaching, I mean, teaching's an interesting one. I'll deal with that first, because we're constantly reviewing our courses. You know, again, students, I talked about co-creation. We see students as coming along, and what they do now, you know, to view them as just customers is oversimplistic, but equally to pretend that students are thinking and behaving the same way as they were 30 years ago is also very naive from our point of view. So the truth is, we think it's about they are partaking in an experience, and we facilitate that, we help with that, and they have access to all the facilities to empower themselves through the university experience, which certainly, you know, we've adapted very rapidly to online, but we would hope would be an online and offline campus experience going forward. So we're teaching a lot of marketing as it's been taught before, but building upon a kind of fit for purpose future-proofing in it. So we are looking at the latest technologies and how those work with companies and how they use those, and always trying to kind of, one of the joys, I suppose, of being an academic is you can look around at what's out there and build that into your lectures, your areas. So, for example, we're teaching about relationships and customer service and building loyalty. I've just been putting together some lectures for the week after next with some master's students. And that's interesting stuff, how to build long-term loyalty. We're teaching more and more digital marketing as well, I have to say. Not me specifically, I touch upon that, but a lot more digital marketing is being taught. In terms of research, as I touched upon at the start, I'm doing a lot of work around societal marketing. So to give you an example, I'm working with our health faculty where we are looking at people's health behaviours. A classic example would be, you know, the very successful stop smoking campaigns that have been around in various countries over the last sort of, you know, 15, 20 years, but some more successful than others, and how the skills and the psychology of marketing can be used positively to influence people and their choices in the right way, not coercing people, but getting people, you know, understanding why they make choices. And that, you know, that's, we see that every single day. I've seen a lot around at the moment with the current restrictions in lockdown about why people, some people adhere very closely to rules, some people almost disregard them. The vast majority obey most of them most of the time and want to do the right thing. There's a lot of consumer behaviour psychology in that, and that fascinates us. So we're working on areas around that. I'm doing some work around, I'm working with a Canadian university looking at the, they have a legal cannabis market, a retail market in Canada since 2018. We're looking at some of the buyer behaviour and the learning from that and how the rest of the world can learn from that around how education markets itself. So marketing in many different formats and forums rather and sectors, but particularly around adding societal benefit and doing positive things. You know, we are influenced, I'll shut up in a minute here, but we are influenced. An overarching thing that sits across the university and across everything we do is the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. I don't know if you're aware of them, but there's 17 things that the United Nations have decided and marketed that should be out there. So it's basic things which in many ways are common sense. So decent work, clean water, things like this. But these are a great umbrella that sits across everything we do at the university, and we're often very mindful of them. And I like to see my work within that, rather than, whilst it will always be necessary, just getting people to buy more consumer products. I don't see that as where my work is going in the future, really, though clearly the skills can still be applied to that. Does that answer your question? I hope so.
It does, Chris. Thank you very much. So what we're going to do next, Chris, we're just going to go to some questions that have come from some great students in Bournemouth University. You might know that place quite well.
Yeah.
So this is the Student Business Society. And we asked if, as part of our collaboration on this podcast series with Bournemouth University, we asked for the students to get involved and pose some questions, which we thought might be just some interesting insights to share with our listeners. So I'm just going to go to the first question.
How important is storyboarding in branding?
I think it's very much, and many things are cyclical and become fashionable. And are they fashionable because people want them or because advertising, marketing agencies, marketing consultants decide that that's the way forward? And I think storytelling is one of those. You gave the example earlier of Southern Comfort. You know, they are well placed to tell a story because I think if you have something that resonates with people, some history, some heritage that interests people, but not every company is able to tell a story. Having said that, it gives you, if you look around at your company, your brand, you can often find, so let's say, we're talking about really small businesses, you start a coffee shop, there's many, many other coffee shops out there. The high streets are full of them. There's many barbers, hairdressers. But if you've got a story to tell, something about you, about how you came to start your business, about something you do, where you source your products, your skills, the people that work there, straight away, that is the basis of a brand personality. So I think storytelling, whilst, to answer your question succinctly, whilst there's a danger, it's been kind of, you know, it's a fashionable area of brand theory. I think there is some real honest value behind it. And I think it is important, done in the right way, though.
Thank you, Chris. Our next question from the Student Business Society.
What do new startups need to be careful of when branding their company?
They need to be careful about overclaiming things or saying things that aren't entirely true, overpromising, because as I said before, we live in a far more transparent world where, and if you, as you know very well, if you get one or two very upset customers, they can get out there and get their message out there. And, you know, you're dealing with a bigger issue than you might have sort of 20, 30 years ago, because we all have a platform now. So they need to be careful of managing that. And I would say also of overcomplicating the brand. Just come up with, as much as you can, a clear simple proposition. And the third thing I would say is try and understand your audience. Take some time, take a step back and think, who exactly are we aiming at? It's clearly, we all understand marketing these days to a degree, but you're not looking at, your audience is not everybody. Even if, to give your example, it's a coffee shop, or even if it's a barber's, you need to sort of think, what type of coffee shop, what type of barbers are you? Who are your audience? And make sure that what you do is resonating with them. And one final thing is, I think that sometimes there's a kind of marketing myopia out there where people who are in small businesses, they're so busy, they're flat out just trying to make everything work. They assume because they think of things in a certain way that their customers will also think of things in that same way. You have to try and take a step back objectively and really understand your consumers and what they want and need going forward.
I must admit, Chris, those last two points you made, I definitely can really see that happening on a regular basis. You know, I touch on the work we do in Dorset, and you know, in the very early stages, especially for companies, it's a challenge to take that step back. Often the idea of the business is born from experiences that they've had, maybe you know, working for other people or perhaps seeing an opportunity. So it can be a real challenge, I think, to take that step back once the business has got up and started, because it becomes about operations, logistics, it becomes about that next sale. So yeah, I can kind of correlate to that, and I do see it, and I think if businesses are able to take that step back at an early stage and look at who are we trying to position this to, it will help them in the long run. And if, you know, in the work that you do, the work that I do, the work that other, you know, marketers can do to help companies understand that is a good thing, I think, because otherwise you do see a lot of people get to a point, year two, year three, and they've tried to appeal to a mass audience because they felt like that was the best approach to take to enable sales. It actually, I think, can shorten the lifespan of that business because they haven't thought that through in those early stages. So yeah, I definitely agree with you on that.
Yeah, everything you said, I wholly agree with. You know, you have to think about it. It's tempting to do that, but you can't appeal to everybody. You sometimes have to take that step back and focus. And consumers now, we all expect choice. We don't just want coffee. You know, when I was growing up as a kid, it was, yeah, you'd get a coffee, and a coffee was a coffee. It was white or it was black. Now we all know about what the coffee market has done. So that's an analogy, I guess, for business generally, really. You have to focus and know your customers. And just because you think something or want something, I think you made a very good point. People are shaped by their experiences. So they go out and think, well, I like this. I know about this. So I'm going to get out there because other people will. And maybe some will if you're lucky, but you can't assume that.
And our next question, Chris.
Apart from the company name and logo, what else does a brand need to do to show their personal brand and increase their sales?
Well, I mean, company name and logo, decide upon what your values are, what you stand for. Look at your competitors. How are you different from your competitors? You know, what makes you distinctive? And then find a clean, simple way of communicating that through a story. So, you know, if you've got some heritage, some history, don't come up with overly complicated messages, but we can come up with clear, simple messages now. And we have the platforms now through social media to cost effectively. I won't say do it in a free way, because nothing really is free. There's always an indirect cost, but to cost effectively communicate those things out there. So really understand what it is that's distinct about you and translate that into a story, a proposition, and some points that you want to keep communicating. And come up with, it might sound something that big organizations do, but come up with a marketing comms plan. Okay, so are you going to do any PR? Are you going to try and get out there to the media, the press? And what are you going to say? What do you want them to say about you? Are you going to drip stories through your website? And also, you know, I've come up against this many times. I won't name names, but a couple of large and medium-sized businesses in Dorset, in Hampshire, I've worked with, and they have social media presence, but they don't really say anything on it. They've got a Facebook account. They've got a, you know, a whatever account, because they feel they should. But really, you've got to be saying something. You've got to give people a reason to follow you and a reason to read your posts. So what is that story? What is that? So decide upon all those bits that come beneath the water of your iceberg analogy there. You've got your logo and your name at the top. That's great. That's the shiny bit. That's the lovely bit. What does that stand for in people's minds?
I remember, and you've touched on these as, actually it was in the previous podcast recording we did, we mentioned Jimmy's Iced Coffee as a local company who do some great marketing and branding. And I always remember I talked to Jimmy many years ago, an analogy that's sort of sat with me was about putting that stake in the ground. which I sort of admired in the sense of being very committed to go, this is what we represent and we are going to stick to this through thick and thin. And, you know, in terms of appealing to an audience base, that's worked really well for them, certainly, I think. I mean, it's probably tweaked over the years very subtly, but the core of it, those messages and the audience they wanted to attract.
Yeah.
That for me, on a, not just a Dorset basis, but UK international, is a great example of someone thinking about all those elements underneath the water, you know, it appearing a certain way out of the water, the iceberg analogy. But yeah, a great sort of putting the stake in the ground. It was always resonated with me about being very committed to that, but not to get too distracted with doing that and saying, this is what we do, this is what we represent, having not thought about the audience behind it. Jimmy and the team there had thought long and hard about who they were resonating with when they put that stake in that ground.
Yeah, they're a great example. We've the universities work quite a bit with them, you know, and I have a 17, you know, and a 14-year-old daughter upstairs, and they both like, you know, they get the Jimmy's Iced Coffee brand, but I think stowed are people in their 20s, 30s, so they've done a really good job. And, you know, another classic example of that sort of branding is we all know Innocent. Now, Innocent are no longer an independent company. They, you know, but the original idea for Innocent, the product itself is incredibly simple. You know, you come up with smoothies, you pulp up fruit, etc. You put it in a carton, you sell it. But it's the brand that made them distinctive. They were one of the first to use this jokey, informal tone of voice, like they are your friend. You know, the way they chat to you is like your friend does. It's very, very informal. And I've noticed that many, many companies are adopting that these days. You know, if you look at communications from years ago, you'd never have got your bank writing to you like, you know, saying, hey, how are you? How about this? Had you thought about that? We're there to help you. You know, but now that kind of jokey, informal, friendly tone of voice has become widely adopted. But they were one of the first to do that. And I'm saying very successful at building a brand position for a product which could have been not that distinct, really.
Sure. And so, and what you're suggesting there is that transition from the B2C, business to consumer, and then business to business, B2B world. I've definitely seen that in the past 5 years, that shift over. So where you're talking about that more friendly human approach to marketing in the B2C world has floated across into the B2B world.
Yeah.
And almost to me now, there isn't a degree of separation because it's about you're focusing more on that human element, which I think is, to me, on a personal level, I much prefer, because let's talk on a level that isn't we at ABC Limited believe that, you know, yeah. Doesn't, certainly to me, doesn't connect. It's let's have a more human conversation and let me decide if your product or service is right for me. But I feel it's the right approach, as certainly in the times that are in, that more human, real element. But not everyone can do it, right? Not every brand can get away with that and can position themselves in that way. And I guess this goes back to audience type again.
Yeah, it does. It does, yeah. I think you're right, that informality. But I come back to your point earlier, actually, and I'd be interested in your view on this. There's so many TV ads for major building societies, for one, who they just, the TV advertising is, it looks like when you're doing an online chat or you're on Zoom with it, you know, there's 20 little tiles with people all talking. And I guess that's what they've got to do to react to the times now. But I think there's a danger of overbranding that, really, and becoming a little bit tiresome for some people, or maybe that's me being cynical, I don't know.
maybe this is what we're realizing, Chris, is analytical you know what a lot of companies are doing, that they're sort of plastering stuff, aren't they, little plasters over the moment in time they feel is probably the best strategy. We none of us know whether kind of a makeshift marketing or comms or advertising plan for now, whether that is the right approach. But you know, everyone, I think you've got to make some changes, haven't you? And you've got to be seen to making changes, but changes that are right and right for your audience. But I think if you're going to focus on an audience type, you run the risk of alienating some people. Final question for you, Chris, from the Student Business Society at Bournemouth University. What has been your favourite rebrand of a company in the last 10 years?
Oh, that's a really good one. I mean, there's been some disastrous ones. Can I go back into ancient history rather than necessarily in the last 10 years? Because one springs straight to mind, actually. Lucozade. Do you know the brand Lucozade? Now, Lucozade used to be marketed as a product that was, their strapline, if I recall rightly, off the top of my head, was Lucozade AIDS Recovery. It was sold as a product when you weren't well. And I think the TV advertising was a little boy who wasn't very well. His mum brought him a glass of Lucozade. Now, they realised pretty quickly, well, not that quickly, actually, but they'd ultimately realised that That was therefore making it almost like a distress purchase. The brand, it comes back to the brand values. The association was with when you're not well. And nobody loves products, you know. You don't buy cough sweets when you're feeling great, etc. And so it was almost positioning itself as a quasi-medicine. And that was fine. They had their market niche. They were doing okay. But they realized that actually they could repurpose what they did and make themselves about positivity and energy and health and all this stuff about isotonic drinks. So they totally went away from the Lucozade Age Recovery to being a sports drink and tapping into that whole movement and interest in that area and sector. And did so very successfully, actually, to the point where if you talk to many younger people now and say Lucozade used to be about these things, people will say, really? You know, so yeah, I think that's a great sort of old school example, one which is still around. So yeah, that would be one for me, actually, Rich. Yeah.
And similarly, Coca-Cola, right? Didn't it position itself as some sort of health related? I don't know if it was to do with the caffeine or something. I'm sure back in its early days, it was similar.
Yeah, they did, yeah. And the classic one is, yeah, and we talked about Guinness. Now, Guinness clearly does have sort of health properties. Now, Guinness actually is another one who've done a fantastic rebrand. Again, I'm showing my age because the classic rebranding time was in the, I would say, the very late 90s. They got a very innovative, because Guinness was seen as a drink. We often use it as an example in marketing of those classic rebrands. It was seen as a drink that your uncle drank, and people would sort of buy a pint of Guinness and nurse it in the corner. It was a bit of an old guy's drink or a middle-aged guy's drink. But they, I think there's a guy called Trevor Beattie. They used some of his imagery, and they had very innovative, arty, challenging advertising, which had nothing to do with the qualities of the product or the drink. It was all about art and style and positioning. And that totally repositioned Guinness to being sort of quirky, alternative and cool. And they've managed to maintain that to a point ever since, actually. So that was you want to look at rebranding, look at Guinness.
Certainly. And, you know, Guinness over the years in terms of advertising have you know, been incredible. Some of the best adverts still to this day, I think. The certainly for me, the horse wave advert was such an iconic almost piece of film, wasn't it, in a way? They took it to a whole new level.
Which is part of the kind of movement I was talking about. Yeah, yeah.
Excellent, Chris. Well, that rounds up our questions from the Student Business Society at Bournemouth University. And thank you to the students that asked those questions. That's been great and given a nice different perspective for you, the listener. I'd like to say thanks, Dr. Chris, for joining us today. It's been a good conversation. I would love to talk more to you about marketing and branding. I would have loved to have had my dissertation here for us to pull it apart and talk about it all on branding and super brands. Maybe I'll find it, Chris, and send you some extracts which you can share with your students.
Please do.
it's been a really good conversation, Dr. Chris, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And we look forward to our partnership with Bournemouth University and talking with the likes of yourselves and other students and professors in the near future. So thanks for being part of this, and thanks for sharing a voice to the Dorset community.
Yeah, happy to help anytime. And really enjoyable. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
Thank you for listening. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to head to our website to sign up to the events we have on offer, hosted by some of Dorset's top business experts.